Thank you, Deborah. Oh, wow, that's really loud. Thank you for sacrificing a beautiful evening to come and listen to me and to have a conversation. I hope we can make this a conversation rather than just me. I can tell stories for a long time, and I hope to tell a few, but would also love to just interact with you on the content that I'm going to present. I want to explain also what this picture was. Deborah was asking me just before we were starting. This is a piece of graffiti written on the separation wall, as it's called, that runs through the middle of the West Bank in the Holy Land. And it separates Palestinians from Israelis. It separates people from their lands. It separates people from the possibility of reconciliation. And it also prevents terrorist attacks. And there are many places with some very interesting graffiti, but this was a photo that one of our staff took. Perhaps not meant in irony. It seems a bit hopeless when it's written and scrawled on a rusty wall that's separating people so in such a severe way, but it's also heartfelt. So I'm going to tell a few stories about what that looks like, but before I do, I probably need to explain a few terms. Peace builder is a term that needs some unpacking, but I found this meme on the internet. My mom does think that I dodge bullets a lot of the time, and that's been true on a few occasions, but it's not usually my work. Society does perhaps lionize peace builders a little bit, make them sort of Mother Teresa figures, perhaps excessively so. My friends think that I sort of gallivant around the world. That's actually a picture of Bono, the lead singer of U2, and his wife traveling somewhere in Africa. The US State Department might think that that's a picture of a journalist meeting with Osama bin Laden. They might think that I'm sort of hanging out with the wrong people. political scientists and anthropologists and sociologists might think it's all a bit naive and sort of hippie and can't we just have peace? And then on some days I sort of feel a bit like Nelson Mandela, you know, when things are going really well, you feel like you're really contributing somehow to the beating heart of peace around the world, when what actually most of us as peace builders spend time doing is listening. If we're doing our job well, we are sitting in consultations around the world and we're listening well. We've got really big ears to find out what's going on and what are the right interventions that can be brought to bear on that situation. What are the local capacities that can be harnessed and empowered to build peace? So I thought I'd unpack the term just with one more slide, because these are terms that sometimes trip us up, and this is the interactive portion right away. So which of these photos would you say describes peacekeeping? The top one, so the blue helmets, right? So they're given a mandate from the UN Security Council. In this case, these are peacekeepers from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And they are usually soldiers for hire, essentially. The UN hires them from local military forces around the world who get paid by the UN for their troops. And they are there to keep the peace, to enforce a peace agreement usually, or to protect civilians from being harmed. What about peacemaking? Which picture would describe that for you? Okay. Right. So some peacekeepers might have to make peace on occasion. Right, if there's no peace to keep, they might have to make it. Right. Typically, the term of art does refer to official mediation, so the picture of Hillary Clinton mediating between Mahmoud Abbas and Benjamin Netanyahu, that's typically the term that's used to describe brokering peace agreements, negotiations, signing a peace agreement, is usually referred to as peacemaking. Peace building, we don't really have a picture that describes in one sort of iconic way what peace building looks like. I have a bunch of definitions that I'll show you later in the slides, but it is, I've actually been tempted to call it peace growing, because it often feels to me a bit more organic, a bit more chaotic, less controlled, and it's very different from these other two ways and modes of thinking, the peacekeeping being this very militarized exercise, very heavily funded. And it does good work. There's no disputing their effectiveness. Nor is peacemaking itself you know, an unhelpful exercise. It's very useful. At the same time, peace building, in our experience, is the most sustainable way to achieve peace. So you can negotiate a document, but that takes years to get people to the table. You might be able to enforce a peace agreement, but if their hearts are still divided, it's only going to last as long as the peacekeepers are still there. So peace building much more goes to the roots, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. These are some of the questions that we discussed when Deborah and I were talking about what this talk could cover. And I can cover all of these. I can cover some of them depending on your own appetite for detail. This can be a choose your own adventure style presentation if you wish. Otherwise, I will just sort of go through it sequentially and try to touch on a variety of topics so that you'll get the full slate of possibilities of what peace building looks like. So current practice, how are peace builders trained, what kind of tools do we use, and then some trends that are going on in the sector, as well as what does faith have to do with all of this. Let me start by telling a couple of stories that tell the story, that tell us how peace is done today. And I would like to start in northern Uganda. So this picture was taken a few years ago in a town called Gulu, which is in northern Uganda. Has anyone heard of Gulu before? How about the Lord's Resistance Army? Does that name ring a bell? Right, a few years ago there was a viral video on YouTube about the Lord's Resistance Army. And it painted the picture of a very, just incredibly evil warlord. Joseph Kony is his name. Joseph Kony is still alive. He's no longer in Uganda, but 10 years ago, he and his band of guerrillas had, they don't really have a political agenda other than chaos and murder and death. That's their agenda. They're not trying to establish a separate state. They don't stand for a political party or a faith or an ethnicity. The Lord's Resistance Army is just about sowing chaos. And the way that they exercise their violence is they abduct children from villages in northern Uganda, or they did 10 years ago, in the middle of the night, because many of these villages are not, there's no army presence. They grab those kids and immediately, holding a gun to the children's heads, they force them to watch and even commit egregious human rights violations, including killing their own parents. And it's a very sick psychology, but they know if they do that, the children have nothing to run back to. And then they know they have soldiers for 10 years that they can enslave. This is the wicked logic of the Lord's Resistance Army, and unfortunately, it's not the only place in the world where this logic is used. Along comes Archbishop John Baptist Odama, who is the Archbishop of Gulu Province in Uganda. And John Baptist Odama said, "We have no weapons. What can we do against this threat?" And they decided that one very effective thing they could do is take children with their parents' permission to towns that were more populated and that did have a Ugandan army presence, and they would walk with those children to the towns at night, and they would organize military protection and sleep in the open so that there was no risk of exploitation of children, and then they would walk the children back to their families. They had community networks that did this, that was gender appropriate, that had child protection built into it. And they did this for years and reduced the number of children that were abducted dramatically just by this simple volunteer effort of using safety in numbers and safety in urban presence. John Baptist Odama was part of the Acholi Religious Leaders Peace Initiative. Sorry, it's a bit of an acronym mouthful. And the Concerned Parents of Northern Uganda Association, these two local organizations that banded together with this idea. And I found myself in Gulu in northern Uganda a few years ago because we had opened up submissions globally for a peace prize. Now, World Vision at that time had a small $5,000 peace prize that we awarded every year deliberately to an organization that would be like the anti-Nobel winner. So it would be an organization that no one's ever heard of, that's laboring away with volunteer power, and that is accomplishing incredible results. And we had a global competition, And John Baptist Odama was nominated by the leaders in his community. So we assembled on a hot day. I think pretty much every day in Gulu is a hot day. But it certainly was hot that day, and I was in the tent just to the right of this picture, wearing a suit and virtually expiring in that suit. But I wanted to honor him. And there were probably 3,000 people gathered around the town square in Gulu that day who were coming to honor Archbishop Odama. And there were about 20 speakers lined up, people who couldn't stop saying nice enough things about him, with one exception, one politician who felt obliged to stand up and run his name through the mud, which was an interesting moment. And then he came to the microphone after all of this speaking. And he started by saying, to all the people who have wished me dead over the years, I forgive you. And to the people who have just insulted me a couple of speakers ago, I forgive you. And it was a very powerful gesture. And then he knelt down and he said to all the children of northern Uganda that I was not able to help, that I failed, that I wasn't there for you, I ask your forgiveness. Please forgive me. And I didn't know what to do, so I took my shoes off because I knew that I was standing on holy ground in that moment. It was the only thing I could think to do. The crowd was rendered silent, and there were, among the 3,000 people, probably half of them were children. It was an extraordinary moment. And after he said his brief little words, he took the trophy that we had carried to present to him, and he walked around the entire square and said, this is yours, we share this together. This is your trophy, we did this together. And he went around the whole square like that. It took a while. But the children touched the trophy, the adults cheered, there was a lot of celebration. It was a wonderful moment of seeing the life witness, the long obedience in the same direction of one man who was very quick to say, it's not just me. I'm here representing all of us who have worked together to make this happen, and constantly was shifting the spotlight off himself, unless it was about repentance, and then it was all squarely on him. And just to give one example, one story of an incredibly inspiring peace builder that no one has ever heard about. Even after we gave him the Peace Prize, he got maybe a day of coverage in the Uganda newspaper, and then that was it. But no one globally has really heard of John Baptist Odama unless you're in peace-building circles like me. I'd like to tell you another story. I'd like to introduce you to Noor Nahas. She is now 18. When this picture was taken, she was 15 years old, and she was in New York. IPI stands for the International Peace Institute. It's a think tank in New York that's across the street from the United Nations. And she was there to deliver a report. You can see she's holding a report that has Arabic writing on the front that she and her colleagues had delivered to parliamentarians in Lebanon. And that report had in it recommendations to Lebanese politicians on how to integrate Syrian refugees into Lebanese society. You may know that Lebanon holds the highest burden of refugees in the world right now. Half the population of Lebanon are displaced from the neighboring countries, mostly Syria. It's a massive hosting exercise for which Lebanon doesn't get nearly enough credit. But as you might expect, there's a lot of social tension. Syrians are not always welcome in Lebanon. There aren't that many jobs to go around to begin with, and they are by law forbidden from working. So the condition of Syrian refugees in Lebanon is not fantastic. And so they get discriminated against. They get violence is acted against them. And Noor and her friends, she's from Lebanon, from the Bekaa Valley, which is in one of the kind of border areas where refugees are flooding in. She and her young colleagues, all of them between the ages of 15 and 18, thought it was important to welcome Syrian refugees and create programs where Syrian children could be included, bringing them homework, helping them with their studies if they're getting any kind of studies in the refugee camp. And they were so successful that they were asked to present their policy recommendations to Lebanese parliamentarians, which they did in the form of this report. They even persuaded the Queen of Jordan to write the foreword. That's how organized they were. She's 15. When they came to the Lebanese parliament to present this report and its recommendations, She says, one of the parliamentarians said, "You're so cute. Are you going to sing for us?" And she said, "No, we have some policy recommendations we would like to discuss with you." And that is the reaction that young peace builders around the world, and I've met many young women like Noor. I could tell you stories about a Kosovar young woman, Fatmita Feka, who has very similar experiences. Or a Colombian young woman, Mayerly Sanchez, who I met also when she was 18, and she was speaking to the UN General Assembly. These are young, high, and they're usually women, and they're usually come from very poor backgrounds, which is why World Vision knows about them, and they are high achievers at school. I've met them all over the world, and they have a very similar profile. Jean Arnado from the Philippines, very similar. High achievers, highly motivated, very smart, and fearless. Fearless enough to take on the potential hatred of the other group. So Fatmira's story from Kosovo is she was a Kosovar Albanian, a Muslim, and she knew that there were Serb Orthodox children on the other side of the Ibar River in Mitrovica, in the town that she lived in northern Kosovo, and she just was convicted that she wanted to meet other people like her. She wanted to see how they saw the world. To get a Kosovar Albanian teenager across the river where the Blue Helmets peacekeepers were guarding and keeping the group separated took huge amounts of negotiation from our World Vision staff there, but we got it done. And she ended up meeting a few Serb teenagers and discovering that, like her, they enjoyed popular music. And they started talking, they agreed to meet. Long story short, Kosovo Kids for Peace was formed over several years, and it has now become its own organization, and it has been nominated for prizes. Fatmira is now living in Toronto. She got her master's degree, I forget in what field, and is now serving on the board of a foundation that funds youth peacebuilding work overseas, which is a very cool story. But I've met girls like this, it's usually girls, I've met a few teenage boys as well, but more often than not, it's girls who are doing an incredible job of building peace for their generation and for the next. And it was that motivation that led to this picture. And I'm going to tell another story about this picture. This is taken just down the hallway from the Security Council in the UN building in New York. You might recognize me in the picture. Right there. And this is my friend Saji Prelis. This is Cecile Mazzucarati from the UN Peacebuilding Support Office. This is the Jordanian ambassador to the UN, and this is the Secretary General's special envoy for youth. And what they're holding up is a Security Council resolution on youth, peace, and security. And that resolution took about 4 years to build the political will and to craft it. The actual drafting of the resolution took about 3 or 4 months, only because there had been a huge amount of work by young people themselves to collect policy recommendations from people like Noor and people like Fatmira and people like Mayerle, people like Jean in the Philippines, all over the world. The young people wrote a declaration. 10,000 young people wrote a document that said, here's how adults need to take our peace work seriously. Stop telling us to sing when we come to visit you. And they put their recommendations into then, we helped them put it into UN Security Council language. And at the time, the Jordanian ambassador, by a miracle, and that's the way I would describe it, was willing to sponsor the resolution. And the vote happened on December 10th, 2015, and it was 15-0, unanimous vote. And the debate lasted about 5 minutes. In the Security Council. I was there in the gallery when it happened, and then we came out in the hallway and took this picture. The special representative of the UN Secretary General for Youth, Ahmed Al-Handawi, is standing in the middle, the tall guy in the nice suit. He is now global president of the World Association of Boy Scouts, I think. But at the time, he was the Secretary General's special envoy for youth. And I don't know what his faith background is, but when we were sitting talking about the resolution, we had champagne at 10 in the morning. It seemed the right thing to do. He said, God is a master diplomat because there's no other logical explanation for how this resolution just got passed. And I said, Ahmed, I think you're right. I totally believe that. It took many years of work by many people in this photo and many, many, many more, tens of thousands of people who had been at international meetings. My friend Saji, who I introduced at the beginning, let me just say a word about him. He's the Sri Lankan fellow right here. I'm standing behind him. We have this running joke that we never show up at a meeting where both of us are wearing ties, and this is the only photographic record we have where we're both wearing a tie. Saji grew up in Sri Lanka, and he grew up at a time when the Tamil-Sinhalese conflict in Sri Lanka was particularly deadly, and had a personal experience of having a Tamil friend of his die in his arms after being shot by a government soldier. He then left Sri Lanka, went to Los Angeles, and got involved in local inter-gang peace work in Los Angeles for many years before he took on his role now with an organization called Search for Common Ground, which is a top organization for youth peace builders. Just an example of, I could tell so many stories of the people in that picture and the backgrounds that they came from, but I hope that gives you a flavor of the breadth and depth of peace-building work today, the personalities, the faces, the names, the stories, and I'd be happy to unpack more of that when we get into the questions and the interaction. I could tell many more stories. I did talk about Kosovo Kids for Peace already. That's a picture from one of their award ceremonies. I will say just a little bit about the Great Lakes Peace Initiative. Not our Great Lakes, the real Great Lakes in Africa. The Great Lakes region is, loosely speaking, Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, and then sort of wider countries around that, Uganda, South Sudan, Tanzania sometimes comes in to say that they're part of the Great Lakes region. But there's an initiative that's been running now for about 10 years. World Vision and Mennonite Central Committee, Duke Divinity School, and a local Rwandan NGO helped found this. And it is a network of Christian peace makers and peace builders, so actual brokers of peace negotiations, as well as grassroots peace activists. And they meet every year in January in Uganda now. And in that picture, I'll just talk about three of the people. So starting with Reverend or Father Emmanuel Katongole. He's a Catholic priest. He's wearing the red suit with the gold bands on it. He was at Duke University Divinity School when the initiative started. He's a Ugandan Catholic priest, did his doctorate in Belgium, I believe, and is a very well accomplished theologian, but felt compelled to support this interconfessional, ecumenical network of Christian peace builders across the Great Lakes region in Africa. Standing to his left is Bishop Taban from South Sudan, who is an extraordinary man who at 80 years of age is still jogging in the desert in South Sudan from village to village to help facilitate peace talks, and he boasts about his calisthenics exercises. And on the far right is Angelina Atiam, who has had many roles over the years, Concerned Parents of Uganda Association. Her daughter was abducted by the LRA, and when I first met her, her daughter was still in captivity. Thank God her daughter was released back to her several years after I met her. But she has continued to tirelessly campaign for the release of the children that are still in captivity. And there's only been one occasion in my life when a room shook when someone was praying, and it was when Angelina Atiam prayed for the release of children from captivity in LRA. We were, one of the activities that happens at the Great Lakes Peace Initiative is worship, and the worship times are amazing. And when Angelina prays, the room shakes. It's not because she has a loud voice, there's just a presence of God that descends that is undeniable. And as we know, the fervent prayer of righteous people affects much, and in Angelina's case, that is incredibly true. I could go on and on. There's so many stories of the peace heroes that we'll never hear from, that the Nobel Committee will never discover, but they're out there doing incredible work. And certainly in the case of the Great Lakes Peace Initiative, one of the hallmarks of their peace work has been journeys of lament. So instead of taking a triumphalist approach to reconciliation, saying, yes, Jesus is calling us to reconcile, they start by saying, first, we must listen. And they go on pilgrimages of pain, they call them, pilgrimages of pain and lament. So they would go to genocide sites in Rwanda, and they would bring Congolese Christians with them. If you know anything about the conflict between Congo and Rwanda, they blame each other for what happened in the Rwandan genocide and everything since. And so to take Congolese pastors into Rwandan genocide sites is an incredible act, but necessary in order to experience the pain to motivate us to then be involved in peace work. It's been a very instructive practice for my own work to see how they do that. Okay, I could go on and on. Let me say a little bit about the tools that we use. This, if you're not familiar with World Vision, this is our mission and our vision statement. So we are an international partnership of Christians. So as working for World Vision International, I'm sort of part of the federation, or if you think about World Vision as a brick wall, World Vision International is sort of the mortar between all the different bricks. So World Vision Canada is one of the big bricks. World Vision Rwanda is a brick. World Vision India is a brick. World Vision International sort of holds it all together. So you don't see us a lot. We're thin, but we kind of are the glue that holds the partnership together. And it is our mission to follow our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And our focus is on the poor and the oppressed. And we believe that God's kingdom is effecting transformation around the world without us. But we would like to be part of that. We would like to be part of that work that God is already doing. But the work already happens ahead of us. All the stories I've just told you, those are outside of World Vision. We get to come alongside, we get to come along on the ride for, but that's God's work. God always goes ahead of us. And our vision is life in all of its fullness for every child and the volitional capacity for the rest of the world to get behind that vision. That means grassroots work. It also means UN influencing or World Bank, and our staff around the world are constantly migrating between very, very local issues and national and global issues with that focus on children. And then we have a definition of peace building that is perhaps poetic, whimsical, you might say, but it has this idea of bringing out the capacities that exist, the resilience that's already there, and facilitating it to shine, to resolve its own difficulties. And we believe that when we do that, we are witnesses to God's healing power to overcome violence and to heal the effects of it over time. But we also have to work on justice. So in our field, often it's peace and justice are talked about as if they were at odds with each other. The biblical picture does not put those things at odds, but our world does. Our world sometimes says, okay, we can have peace, or at least the appearance of peace, if we make a few sacrifices on the justice front. Or we can have full accountability and justice and prosecution of war crimes, but we'll never resolve the peace. And we are fundamentally convinced that the biblical model is that peace and justice are friends, and that it's God's design for those two things to come together in one package. But in the world we see, even human rights activists and peace builders go at it. Even right now in Colombia, some of you know the peace agreement is beginning to fray at the edges, and some human rights activists are saying, well, it's because we made too many human rights accommodations to seek peace, and others are saying, well, no, if we don't get that peace, we'll never have any accountability for human rights. But we believe that they all go together. So there's so much scripture that we could mine to explain why there is a peace-building mandate to our work. The peace-building part of what World Vision does is actually quite small, financially speaking, and in terms of people. There are probably about 40 people around the World Vision family of 35,000 staff who are full-time peace people. The rest focus on health or nutrition or water sanitation and hygiene or livelihoods, our big sectors. Peace-building is one of those cross-cutting things that we do. So it doesn't show up as a huge line item in our budget, but it is core to realizing our mission and our vision for God's wholeness and healing. the theme verse of the team that I used to lead, until a couple of months ago, I was the director of peace building, and our department verse was Psalm 34:14, seek peace and pursue it. And the whole verse is depart from evil, seek peace, and pursue it. And the reason that we have enjoyed that theme verse over many years is the pursuit part. Because peace is never a destination. Peace is a process. Peace takes long, dedicated work, many hours, many years, many tears, and it's God's work, and it's a pursuit. It's not, oh, okay, we done it, checked it, got the resolution, everything's fine now, we don't have to do any more work. It's a long-term, constant cycle and process that we have to keep practicing. One of my personal favorite verses, as you might imagine, is Matthew 5:14, blessed are the peacemakers. But I think one of the most radical phrases comes later on in the Sermon on the Mount. It's the whole teaching, Matthew 5 to 7, I think is revolutionary. There isn't another teaching like it in all of world religion that I've come across. The idea that we should love our enemies is a radical, crazy thought. And yet, evidence shows that it's really the only thing that works. I remember a conversation with a Harvard political scientist who had studied peace agreements over the years across multiple societies, multiple cultures, multiple faiths, and was presenting their results at a UN meeting in front of non-governmental organizations and government experts, and said through gritted teeth, forgiveness works. And the reason they were gritting their teeth was it felt like such a religious statement to make, that this very Christian idea of forgiveness could be, according to the literature, so effective. The evidence is so clear. That's how long-term conflict gets resolved, forgiveness. The reason it's difficult is you can't tell people, hey, you need to forgive. That's the hardest thing to say. But we also know, the evidence says, when that happens, when that flame lights in people's hearts, that decision to forgive, that has been the deciding factor in keeping Rwanda at peace since 1994, is that choice to forgive. It's the same thing that stopped South Africa from having a bloodbath after the end of apartheid, was decision by some very key leaders, including Nelson Mandela, but Bishop Tutu and so many others, to forgive in spite of all the reasons they had not to. That's the transformation that's possible. So we feel that we have, in World Vision, we have the Bible on our side in terms of the peace-building work. Reconciliation is possible. So let me say a few things about the tools that we use, and I can see that we probably need to move to questions quickly because the heat is getting to you. If there's one thing that I would like to communicate about the tools that peace builders use today, it's understanding conflict. And we use this volcano diagram in our own internal training because often I remember being in a conflict analysis workshop in Burundi, and one of our participants said, we are sitting on volcanoes. Everything is fine. So our exercise was actually to unpack why everything is not fine. Understand, why is this happening? And peace builders around the world use conflict analysis tools to do this, because it would be incredibly naive to say we're here to start a peace process if you didn't take time to understand why there's a volcano there in the first place. So it helps us understand forces and trends and pressures, and we use a number of different tools to do that. We've actually created a couple of our own tools. So we created something called Making Sense of Turbulent Contexts. The short version is it's a four-day workshop where you review the history of a country, the major actor groups, the economic assets, which powers and parties control those assets, therefore what is likely to happen in the next 6, 12, 18 months, what are the underlying driving forces, and then what do we need to do about it. That all happens in 4 days with 25 people, but we come out of it with a very reliable prediction of what's going to happen. So some of you may know South Sudan was the world's newest country in 2011. It broke off from Sudan itself after a very bloody civil war, and they became a new country. and then 2 years later descended into their own civil war in the country they'd just created. And it was essentially a face-off between Salva Kiir, at the time the head of state, and Riek Machar, who was one of the military commanders. One of our facilitators did a conflict analysis in Juba, in the capital of South Sudan, in 2012, and it predicted exactly what would happen a year later. And it wasn't because the tool is amazing. All it was good listening. And we listened to our South Sudanese staff, our Nuer staff, our Dinka staff. We listened to people from other organizations, and they all said, this is going to happen. There's going to be a blow up. And the international community was in total denial. The UN was caught totally by surprise when it happened a year later. But the South Sudanese knew. They knew exactly what was going to happen. So it's all about listening. So that's the Making Sense of Turbulent Context tool. The other tool that we use is based on the Do No Harm methodology. The Do No Harm tool is not just the Hippocratic Oath, but it's a specific book that was written right after the Rwandan genocide that looked at the effect of aid organizations when there was already a conflict. So when well-meaning aid organizations come into a conflict-stricken community, they become part of the conflict, whether they want to or not. They're providing assistance, and they're already making decisions on who needs that assistance, and other groups are not getting that assistance. And so you're creating inequalities. And so the purpose of the book, the Do No Harm book, was to say, understand the contexts. Make sure that your aid interventions harness the local capacities for peace rather than irritate the divisions that exist. And it's just a few straightforward steps on how to do that. So we train thousands of staff and other NGOs in the Do No Harm methodology around the world because it's just a basic duty of care to the community that you're working with to understand how your own aid activities, well-meaning though they might be, could actually make things worse. And then we've developed another tool. If you're interested and if you wanted to look them up later, you can find them at that email or that web address. We've got a brochure that talks about all of our tools. We've now developed a rapid one. That's what the one on the top right. We love acronyms, if you might have noticed. The Good Enough Conflict Analysis for Rapid Response, what we call GCAR. I just had one of my colleagues do one in Erbil in northern Iraq a couple of weeks ago. And it does provide very real grassroots up voices, not the Economist version or the New York Times version of what's going on, but local voices version of what's going on. Really, really important tool. So what I want to say is, what tools do peacebuilding people use? They use listening tools, basically, local listening tools. The other thing I would say that may surprise you is that we work with a lot of data. There is a lot of data. There are a lot of data are being gathered by different organizations about conflict, about violence, about arms flows, about abuse of children, about sexual violence, about tendency to autocracy. There's all kinds of indices that you can study and watch the numbers on. And I actually spend a lot of my time looking at spreadsheets of numbers, as much as sitting with people and listening to them. There is a lot of data, and you need to understand it as a peace builder. Okay, what are some trends? I'll try to wrap it up really quickly. Trends in the world that we work, shrinking humanitarian space. So this is a kind of term that NGOs use too much, but let me unpack it a little bit. In places like Burundi today, I was just speaking to our national office director 2 weeks ago. The government has now forced all nonprofits, all NGOs, to use the one central government bank. We can't use commercial banks anymore to transfer funds. Whenever we are trying to fill a local position, we have to ask the government for permission on who we can hire. When we want to send foreign visitors, which we have from time to time, all of our staff in Burundi are Burundians, but sometimes staff visit from the Canada office, or I might go in a couple months, we need now special permits to leave the capital city. You can drive across Burundi in about 3 hours, but you need a permit now. So that space is shrinking, and that's true in many other contexts where governments are really, before they let nonprofits and non-governmental organizations go ahead and do our work because we were doing good and they liked that. But the trends over the last several decades have been a shrinking humanitarian space. We're getting more and more observed and controlled and monitored and tied up in red tape, in bureaucratic red tape. Faith is, of course, no secret as being politicized. I have certainly seen this in terms of the increasing influence of radicalized Islamic voices, but also Christian voices are becoming instrumentalized. So the Central African Republic, again, a country no one's ever heard of, but it has a huge humanitarian crisis going on right now, and there is a conflict between Christians and Muslims, and both are using violence to perpetrate horrible acts against each other, forgetting what our faiths teach. So there's this politicization of faith. We certainly see it south of the border, but there is that is affecting our work overseas more and more, and it's not just Islamic radicalization. It's seen across the board. I have seen, this is the weirdest thing ever, but there are two countries where I've seen violent Buddhists. Violent Buddhists, Myanmar and Sri Lanka. They will kill people in the name of Buddhism. It's the most bizarre thing. But the politicization of faith is certainly something we've seen over the last couple of decades. And then there's the countering violent extremism agenda. So countries like the United States and the UK in particular have a sort of global war on terror orientation. And they're trying to leverage all of their aid investments toward that agenda of winning hearts and minds. And so they are offering money to humanitarian organizations to say, oh, well, could you just de-radicalize those terrorists over there? But, you know, just call it food distribution or, you know, whatever it is that you do. There's a lot of pressure on organizations like ours to accomplish the foreign policy objectives of the United States or the UK or Canada. Before, it used to be government would give aid to NGOs and say, we don't care what the politics of this are, we'll pursue our foreign policy over here. This is just the right thing to do to give our aid. But now more and more governments are compressing aid and diplomacy and security and defense interests all into one channel. Makes our lives very difficult. Okay, last slide. What's faith got to do with it? You might think that because of all the things I've said, politicization of faith, that this sort of meeting can't happen, but it happens all the time. Imam Coker and Pastor Kainwo were actually instrumental in stopping the spread of Ebola in Sierra Leone. And what they did was they traded pulpits, or mihrab, it's called in a mosque. They allowed each other to speak in each other's communities and said, we're in this together. This isn't a disease that's going to discriminate against Muslims or against Christians. We are all in this together, and here's what our faiths say about caring for the sick. And here are some guidelines about how to bury the dead who have died of Ebola. Safe burial practices. They saved thousands of lives, these two men, by explaining how safe burial practices work, but by taking the risk of crossing over into the other's community. But it was extremely effective. And they mobilized faith communities to help get the message out on hand washing and many other things that arrested the spread of the disease. Ebola is now resurging in Congo, as you may have seen in the headlines, so please pray for faith leaders there that they might be part of that struggle. So I've gone a little bit over time. I want to make sure that we have time for conversation about any of these topics. So over to you. Oh, sorry. All the time. Yeah, yes. Whenever I get frustrated, it always helps me to go back to connect with our grassroots friends. And if I'm ever having, you know, first world problems, it doesn't take very long with a Pastor Kainwo or Emmanuel Katongole or someone who's really lived that life to say, okay, my problems, I have no reason to be frustrated right now because you've been doing this for 20 years against insurmountable obstacles and with incredible grace and good humor on top of it. I remember I was speaking in a school a few months ago, and someone said, oh, so it must be so hard to travel to all these places. It must be so difficult. It's not hard for me at all. I get to travel home after a couple of weeks in a in a context like this, and I live in Toronto with my family, and we live safely, and we don't have, you know, people at our door with guns. So no, it's not hard at all. And when I get frustrated, and it is frustrating, those colleagues who are doing the heroic work quickly remind me that you gotta just stay with it. But there is an issue around resilience and long-term staying in this. I have seen people burn out. I keep telling my friend Saji that you saw in the UN picture that he only sleeps 4 hours a night. That's just his thing. I said, dude, you're going to die early if you keep doing that. We need more peace builders who can keep it up for a whole career like John Baptist Odama. The interesting thing is, I was just talking to a stress expert a few days ago. The evidence is clear that prayer is one of the most resilient contributing activities you can do. If you're constantly exposed to stress or warfare or whatever it is, physical exercise, sleep and nutrition, and prayer. The clinical evidence that having a good prayer life makes you much more resilient, makes you able to manage unbelievable levels of stress. And that's certainly, in my observation, the secret of people like Archbishop Odama to get through that frustration. They're people of prayer. They're Angelina Atyam, like they exude a joy under frustrating circumstances I could never hope to have. So yes, it is frustrating, but it's if you have the right eyes to hear and right ears to hear and eyes to see people like the some of the ones you've heard about, it quickly passes. But I need to be reminded by that about that. Yes. I mentioned that I spend a lot of time looking at spreadsheets of data. I'm a data nerd, self-described, but it depends what time frame you're looking at. If you look in a millennia time frame, we live in the most peaceful era of human history. If you look in a century time frame, we are somewhere in the middle. Obviously, the two great world wars were horrible moments, and there have been many other world wars that weren't called world wars since then. If you look at the last 40 years, there was a steady downward trend beginning with the end of the Cold War until about 1994. There was a little spike in global violence, and then it decreased again steadily to around 2007, beginning of the Syria crisis. And since then, things have been going steadily upwards, surpassing the previous high back in 1994 with the Great Lakes conflict. So we're now, if your time frame is in the more recent decades, we're in an alarming upward trend. And if you look at if not just us, but I was at a World Bank meeting on fragile contexts in Washington in March, and there were 1,000 people from the UN system and NGOs and governments. And the bank leadership and the governments that were there said, as we look at our poverty strategies to 2030, the current global framework for poverty, the Sustainable Development Goals, time frame is 2030, we can see that poverty is migrating to the fragile context, the war-affected places. I You said I should define fragile context. Let me quickly define it. Everyone's got their own definition, but they mostly agree that a fragile context is a place where the institutions that would normally be there for citizens have broken apart. And there are many reasons why that might be. It could be informal or formal institutions. We used to talk about it as governments are either unwilling or incapable of providing for their citizens. And now we just talk about institutional capacity being weak. That weakness is increasing for a fixed group of countries, or for a small group of countries. It's not fixed, it's actually growing. Sorry, I should... It's a difficult thing to explain, but overall, the battle against poverty is being won. That's the good news. So if you look at the massive movement of people out of poverty in the last 15 years, it's unprecedented. But then there's this group of basket case countries that are being left behind. They didn't experience any of that poverty elimination surge, and they're getting worse. So the Syrias, the Somalias, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Central African Republic. And the statistics we know are that when countries deteriorate far more rapidly than they improve. So once, it's a slippery slope. So once you go past a certain level of bad governance, it's like you slide all the way to the bottom and horrible things happen and it takes you a decade to climb out of it from the moment you sign a peace agreement. So we're very concerned as World Vision, and so were the people at this World Bank meeting, to move more of our anti-poverty tools to those basket case countries so that we can get the most return on our investment. And we know that that's going to be really, really hard. All the items that go in your too hard basket on your desk, that's those countries. It's all the hardest problems. That's what we're now all focused on. That's the initiative I lead right now in World Vision, but all the other institutions, World Bank, UN, they have the same focus. That's where the highest vulnerability is. For us, it's children in those contexts we're very concerned about. Yeah, so it's getting worse for them. Most of everybody else is experiencing the world getting better. But right now we have the highest levels of displacement since World War II. And more people are on the move than ever before. We have the highest number of interstate conflicts and the highest number of deaths of interstate conflicts and the highest number of armed groups since the Second World War period. So, yeah, that's a disturbing trend, and it really only started from 2007. Sorry, super long answer to a very straightforward question. Oh, right, yes, it was a great question. No. If you look at the global budget for peacekeeping, the Blue Helmets, that's sort of after it's too late, keep a lid on things. The global budget for peacekeeping is about $8 or $9 billion a year. The UN's total budget for peace building is about $200 million. So you can see we still reward too little too late interventions, and we underfund the ounce of prevention stuff. That's true for the Canadian government, that's true for the US, that's true for the UN, European Union, everybody does that. It's just the mechanics of our political system award spectacular after the fact, oh, we better clean it up, rather than those little interventions that actually don't cost that much in the end. But imagine if we could balance out the peacekeeping and the peacebuilding budgets, we'd be able to prevent a ton of conflicts. And I mean, to pick an example, two of the interventions that we're very focused on from a peace point of view that have nothing to do with peace building, nutrition between the ages of 0 and 5. If you provide the right micronutrients, especially iodine, iron, but a balanced diet, you will dramatically improve the likelihood that that child will turn into a peaceful adult. If they don't get some of those interventions, they're gonna become violent adults. That's just the way their brain will be formed. Second thing, education of girls. If you educate girls, every other social indicator improves. And in countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan, we have rates of girls' education that are lower than 30%. You can imagine what kind of ticking time bomb that then becomes. So there are simple things that we can be doing. Thankfully, Canada, to her credit, this government's credit and the previous government, have been very big on girls' education. So that's one thing Canada is making a very proud maple leaf contribution to around the world. It's a little thing that we can do, and we know it's effective. Deborah, you had your hand up earlier, and I... Discouraging. Okay, let me start with encouraging, because I think I'm more, normally a glass half full person. So I was back in New York a few months ago for the report that was commissioned by the resolution you saw. So the resolution said, among other things, listen to young peace builders, they're awesome. And by the way, Mr. Secretary General, we would like a report in a couple years' time on what all these young peace builders are doing around the world and how can we better support them. So we were involved with the formation of that report. We were involved in national level consultations in Sri Lanka and the Philippines, Lebanon, a couple other countries. The lead author is a personal friend, and so we had lots of great conversations. And it was an amazing report, and they had two young women, one from Central African Republic, and another from, might have been Pakistan, anyway, who spoke in the Security Council, which never happens. I've never seen a young person speak in the council at the table to the report. I was going to show a picture of that, actually, because we we went down to the Security Council again, took another picture. That was incredibly encouraging to see the trail from young voices in all these countries make it all the way up to the corridors of power and be listened to. We listened to a whole day of speeches from governments welcoming the report and saying, let's do these recommendations. That was really, really encouraging. Discouraging. I'm going to have to think about that a little bit. I don't normally dwell on it, maybe. Maybe I kind of try to bury it or set it back. So this isn't a first-hand story, but I'll tell a story about a young girl called Emma, who was in a protection of civilians camp in South Sudan. I've not met her, but our national director in South Sudan met her, and he was telling me the story. And when he met her, her mother, who was herself a teenager, 18 or 19. Not clear whether Emma had been born because of sexual assault or not. Possibly that's endemic in South Sudan. And she was receiving emergency nutrition at a protection of civilians site. We have this product called Plumpy Nut, which is basically like a very sticky energy bar. And it's packed full of nutrients, and for somebody who's incredibly malnourished, it's very helpful. So she was getting it that day, and then our national director, Perry, said he went back the next day to visit the project, and she wasn't there, and her mother wasn't there, and he just wondered, is she just one of those statistics? But he connected with her and looked her in the eyes and talked to the mother and like made that connection, but then you don't know what happens after that, and there are millions of stories like that too. I tend to focus on all the really cool, fun, encouraging stories. Maybe that's a survival strategy. Yeah. I would urge you to educate yourselves about some of the countries that I've listed. They're in the news if you dig a bit, if you Google, and to pray for them. And maybe pick one, maybe pick a favorite. You know what, I'm gonna pray for Central African Republic for a year because I saw an article online that I really liked and I'm just gonna, or I know a missionary there, or it doesn't matter. It's okay to pick favorites. And pray for that context and see if there's an organization that you can support. I would love it if you could support World Vision, but if there's an organization you know of that's doing really good work, put your money where your mouth is and where your prayers are. If you would like to get politically involved and support the kinds of initiatives that the Canadian government does, including girls' education, politicians tell us all the time, the more letters that come in, the more responsive we will be. We do actually respond to those calls, those letters. We do make policy based on our sense of what Canadians want. So if you wanted to write to your member of parliament and say, great stuff on the girls' education initiative, let's double it. Or, so I would say, yeah, get educated, pray, give, and be politically active. And it's okay to pick favorites. Find a country, find an issue that you resonate with, that God has put on your heart, that you can stay leaning into. That would be my plea. Yes. Yes. Yeah. There's so much data. So we use a composite index that involves 60 different data points from 3 different sources, and we update it every year. And unfortunately, the data is backward-looking because it's well-researched. It takes a year to kind of validate the numbers. So we keep an index, and it goes. So we have Syria's at the top of the list. No surprise. The Somalia, DRC, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, they're all in the top 10, and so we keep an eye on those. But even within that top 10, there's quite a bit of disparity, the more severe and the less severe. It is really, fragility is a spectrum. So it's not a binary switch. You're either fragile or you're not. There's areas of fragility in our country. There's areas of fragility in the city of Toronto and the city of Hamilton, I'm sure. Places where life feels nasty, brutish, and short. And the extent to which those fragile areas are localized or systemic kind of will tell you how the country works out. So those top 10 countries I was mentioning, they're pretty much fragile from top to bottom, whereas there are countries like Myanmar. I was in Myanmar a couple of years ago. Yangon itself, the capital city, everything's fine. Chinese investment, there are superhighways and infrastructures being built and economies going gangbusters. In Rakhine province, Rohingyas are being slaughtered. And they're fleeing to Bangladesh, which is no amazing Shangri-La, to live on the hillsides, and they're about to get rained off those hillsides, unfortunately, when the monsoon season starts in a couple of weeks. So in Myanmar, it can be just localized to one part of the country, or in Kenya, it's the same thing. Most of Kenya is quite safe and secure, the economy is growing, but then in the north, in the border areas with Somalia and with South Sudan, you have huge refugee influxes, you have terrible poverty, no jobs. So fragility, yeah, it's like the spectrum from complete darkness like Syria all the way to, you know, pockets of fragility here and there. You know, there are places in our country where Aboriginal people are concentrated that are really horrible places. There isn't clean water, there is no rule of law, there's endemic suicide and abuse, and we kind of turn a blind eye to some of those things. I was very grateful for the prayer at the beginning, or the land recognition at the beginning. But yeah, fragility is a spectrum, and it exists everywhere. There's no country that's free from it completely. So when we look at that data, we're trying to put it on a map. Yes. Yes. Yeah. The last time I was in Juba was in 2011, capital. And at the time, our World Vision office was backed onto the Anglican Cathedral in Juba. And they used our generator on Sundays for the services. And, it was a very good relationship. That broke down in 2012 because the architects of that violence and this is evidence of pure evil. They went after, they literally decapitated, and metaphorically decapitated, the peace capacity that had risen up, especially in the church, over the preceding decade. My mentor and my predecessor as director of peace building, Bill Lowry, spent about a decade in South Sudan building the people-to-people peace process between Nuer and Dinka, among others, and trained up church leaders and saw church leaders seize the leadership mantle to build peace and create the conditions that made the referendum possible in a peaceful way. And then when this conflict started between Riek Machar and Salva Kiir, those pastors, those peace builders were the first to be targeted, so that the nascent indigenous capacity to manage peace could be cut off. It was really awful to see. That is beginning to be built back. Bishop Taban, who I showed a picture of earlier, the 80-year-old calisthenics expert, is one of those who survived, and his generation is now resurging and rebuilding that capacity. It's coming back online, but Juba itself is the most dangerous city in the world today. There are random checkpoints, there's just callous violence going on in the streets, so the church has a giant task ahead of it. But you're right, the church is very visible, very well known. Thankfully, the church didn't, for the most part, become complicit in the violence the way, for example, the church in Rwanda was. But the church was silent at times when it shouldn't have been, and one or two church leaders were co-opted by the agents of violence. But for the most part, they were victims rather than perpetrators or agents of change. And there are some cases, other countries, where sometimes the church is with the wrong crowd. But in South Sudan, it's building back, but we need to pray. That's another country you could adopt as your prayer favorite. There are some tremendous church leaders doing amazing things there against all the odds and against sort of this burned out hulk of what used to exist. Yeah, please pray for the Anglican Church of South Sudan in particular, our fellow church members. Yes. Thank you.